The Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee will now come to order. We'd ask folks to find their seats, or if their hearing is done, we need to get started with our hearing. And thank you all for coming today. We have a variety of bills on the agenda, ranging from child care licensing fees to after-school learning grant programs. And I'm going to briefly kick off the committee here. We're going to get the amendments approved, and then Representative Bly will be chairing the committee. Let's see. Representative Ward, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I'll move minutes.
Okay. Representative Ward, moves approval of the minutes for March 1st. Is there any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the minutes are passed. What we have today, members, is a lot of competing committees. So we're going to see how many members we get. We had enough for a quorum based on those who have checked in and then had to move on. First, we're going to have House File 659. So if those who are going to be testifying in that could come forward, Representative Bly.
And Representative Garofalo, I know I can count on you to keep me on the straight and narrow here, right?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman?
Oh, go ahead.
In light of that, perhaps we could have a discussion on Representative Greiling's bill she introduced yesterday. Or
I think we have plenty to discuss. Representative Slawick, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 659 for possible inclusion in the omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee.
So moved. Do you have any amendments that you'd like to present?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I would like to move Amendment DE1.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move Amendment DE1, which basically just gets the bill in shape to delete all. We need to hear the bill.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, I would ask for all those in favor of moving the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Amendment passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, today we have before us House File 659. I'll talk a little bit about the bill, and then I have a few people that want to testify on it and would appreciate your support today. This bill came up for the grassroots level, and it's bipartisan. We have both folks from both sides of the aisle supporting this. And it started with the Scott County Licensed Family Care Child Care Association, who wrote the bill working with State Senator Claire Roebling, who is one of the co-chairs of the Early Childhood Caucus. And this is an issue which unites providers across the state. As you all know, family child care providers are the backbone of every community. And what happened is during the state budget cuts in 2003, the legislature authorized counties to charge providers up to $250 every year in licensing and background check fees. Prior to 2003, family child care providers paid zero in licensing fees and background checks. So, members, this was a big change for family child care providers, and we're going to hear from them on how this worked. What the bill does, it reduces the licensing fee to $50 and centralizes background checks at the state level. And so that would offer more incentives for providers to stay licensed. Providers will be able to put the money back into curriculum, safety measures, and resources for the children in their care. So our hope is that you will look upon this favorably, and I'd like to hear from our testifiers now.
Thank you.
Okay. Just state your name for the committee, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tanya Shorter, and I have been a child care provider in St. Cloud for 25 years. I'd like to introduce you to my fellow child providers who are sitting here with me. On my far left is Hawa Hassan from Rochester. Right next to me is Denise Welty, also from Rochester. And in the audience today are providers from Dakota County, Scott County.
Excuse me, could you pull the mic towards you a little bit more?
I was told not to touch it. Okay. Is that better?
That's much better.
All right. Also with me, I said, in the audience are providers from Dakota County, Scott County, and Carver County. As I said, I've been a child care provider here in St. Cloud for 25 years. I was one of the original founders of the Stearns-Benton County Child Care Association many years ago. I'm here to testify in support of HF 659, the bill to reduce licensing fees and turn the responsibility for background checks to the state. I began my professional career as a teacher, a licensed teacher in high school. What I found I most enjoyed about that career was the personal relationship I formed with just a few of the students in each of my classes. The classes were too big to have a personal relationship with every child. When I started doing child care, I found that I could have that personal relationship with each child in my care, and I treasured that. And that's why I have stayed in child care all these years. I have two messages for you today. The first concerns the licensing fee set by each county. It has become a financial hardship for many child care providers. I am one of them. This month, I will be relicensed in Stearns County. My fee is $175 to be relicensed this year. I live by myself, and I have all the normal bills that any homeowner has. In addition, I pay for my own health care insurance, and that's $600 a month. And that's other testimony for a different committee another day. What I want to emphasize with you right now, and you all understand, is that child care providers are not your run-of-the-mill business people. It is customary in this state for child care providers to subsidize their clients. I don't know of very many professions where that happens. For example, if I have more than one child from a family, I will often give that family a discount. Once I had three children from the family, and they did get a discount in their weekly fee. Or let's say dad's hours have been cut at work, or mom's in between jobs. Many times those families will say, can you help us? And child care providers do. I am proud of us because we are so caring and compassionate. We are not your ordinary business people. As a matter of fact, this month I was kind of hoping that Xcel Energy or the cable company or my grocer, Coburn's, or my pharmacy would step forward and say, Tanya, we'll help you. I was waiting for Xcel Energy to say, listen, it's a tough month. We'll give you $50 off your bill. And I was really hoping that Mr. Coburn would come forward when I was in the checkout and say, you know what? This month we'll take 10 cents off every gallon of milk you buy. Didn't happen. It didn't happen. So that means my children are going to suffer. I have to make up that $175 somehow. That means we're not going to get new Play-Doh this month. They're not going to get the special cinnamon rolls they really like to eat. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask my son a loan, and that hurts. So that's the first thing I want to testify to, that the licensing fees set by the counties have been too expensive, and the cost of our background checks should be borne by the state. The second point I'd like to make is this. If, in fact, implementing licensing fees or raising licensing fees is a legitimate and adequate way to balance the county or state budgets, then can we do that on a fair and equitable basis. I'm speaking to you tongue-in-cheek right now, but I want to make this example clear so you understand what I'm saying. The average child care provider in the state of Minnesota makes $11,000 a year. In Olmsted County, a county that pushed that $250 licensing fee to the max and said, They're going to require that each year. I sat down and I did the math, and $250 is 2.3% of that $11,000 income. I am suggesting that, for instance, licensed teachers who earn $30,000 a year also give 2.3% of their income to their license. And instead of being licensed for 5 years, as they are, they be licensed each year, as we are required to do. That math works out to $707 a year. Does that sound ridiculous to you? Is that way too much? It's the same percentage that I am asked to pay. Then I thought of other licensed professionals. What about a licensed plumber? A licensed plumber, you know, I was up all night memorizing this. A licensed plumber makes $54,000 a year. His 2.3% would work out to $1,242. And I'm submitting to you right now, as I said, tongue-in-cheek, that's fair, because 2.3% of my income is going for my license. And we have said that's fair. I'm just saying let's make it equitable. Let's make it fair for everyone. I wanted to see what the big bucks would look like. So I did all of this on Google. I asked for the starting salary of a beginning doctor, $130,000. 2.3% of his income for a license would be $2,990. And the state of Minnesota would say, now do that every year. Every year you're going to give us $3,000, doctor, for your license. That's what child care providers have been asked to do. And if that strikes you as not fair, then I'm hoping you will understand why I'm asking you to support HF
659.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate you staying up all night and preparing.
I couldn't sleep.
You do the same thing I do, but oftentimes that happens to us too, and it shows the very real needs that are at the legislature. I think the plan, Mr. Chair and members, was we were going to kind of have a group stand in support, but just one testifier. And so at this point, I think we'd be ready for any questions.
Okay.
I did want to show you, these are all postcards that have come from constituents who are supporting us. Right now, he's supporting the bill.
Mr. Chair, we do have one more person that would like to testify.
Yes, sorry.
I am Dolores Frisky, a licensed family child care provider from Scott County, the group that brought this bill forward with Senator Roebling. I would like to bring up 2 points for your committee to consider, is to consider the net income of family child care providers in the state of Minnesota, and also to take a look at Minnesota State Statute 245C.10. For the net income for family child care providers in Minnesota, I have had many providers come up to me since 2003 and said, do counties not understand how much you make? And as our previous testimony said, I'd like to share with you 33% of our gross income is what we take home to pay bills. And in the state of Minnesota, based on how many children are in care in each county, as well as the actual amount of money that parents pay for infant care, toddler, preschool, and school-age care. It comes out to this for 2006, based on child care resource and referral data. Scott County happens to be the highest, with $14,685 as our net income, based on 8.5 children in care. I about cried when I looked at the amount of income from Nobles County. They only have 5.5 children in a family child provider's care with a net income, please listen, of $5,676. One of the things you need to realize in family child care that in licensing numbers, our own biological and adopted children count in the numbers. So therefore, most of us have at least two people in this 8.5 kids in Scott County that don't pay us income. And these children are in our counted numbers from birth until they turn 11. We work long hours, as was already previously. So when you convert even $14,685 as our net income to our take-home pay, you can see we're not making huge bucks. So what we have done in this bill, Senator Roebling sat down with me, we looked at what would be a fair license fee. Prior to the 2003 bill being passed, we did a survey of the state of Minnesota. Providers across the state said, I think we can handle a $50 fee. So that's what we're coming forth with in this one. And we're doing it a little bit differently. We're doing it so that we can clarify two counties. It's a $50 fee for a one-year license, a $100 fee for a two-year license. That way, counties won't have to guess what to charge. For your information, 30 counties in this state have chosen the maximum fee. Another 44 counties have taken the bill that was written in 2003, which has a lot of very fair things in it, and did fair fees for their providers. In other words, about 65% of the counties aren't going to be affected by the actions you would take today by lowering the license fee to $50 for 1 year, $100 for two. The last point I'd like to make has to do with Human Services Background Studies Statute and Subdivision 1 under Background Studies 245C.10 says the following. No applicant, license holder, or individual who is the subject of a background study shall pay any fees required to conduct the study. Based on that, we are very excited to be able to have in this bill the option of the state taking over the background checks for family child care using the system that's in place right now for centers and allowing us equity with centers and not having to have these background checks done every year. And on top of that, it's going to be better than every year because I was told by my licensing unit if I committed a crime or something that would have triggered a negative background check, they wouldn't figure it out until the next year I was licensed. So this way it would trigger right away and a much better situation for kids. So I want to thank you and Child Care Resource and Referral for listening to my testimony.
Thank you, Testifier. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the...
Thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify. My name is Beth Mork. I'm the past director for Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. At this time, I am retired. No one paid my expenses to come here today. I came because this issue is very important to me. Minnesota has lost 1,000 licensed family child care providers since the licensing fees were implemented, and that greatly concerns me. According to our own Minnesota Resource and Referral Agencies, over 50% of the children cared for in homes are cared for in unlicensed homes. To have people drop their licenses and have at least when their minimum standards for licensing, not even to have that as a barrier for protection for our children greatly concerns me. I have five nieces and nephews and two grandchildren who are at least part-time in family child care homes, and I want to make sure that there's at least minimum protections for those people that I love. And I know everybody here can relate to how every family is a two-income family now. It isn't the case anymore where families can, where one person can stay home and raise the children. We don't argue that there should be a fee at all for licensing. What we want is an equitable fee compared to other occupations that are paying licensing fees. And having the background check moved to the state of Minnesota as the way it's being done, we believe is just more efficient and a better catch-all for everyone in protecting our children. So we're all in favor of doing that. We know that this will be a burden to counties in losing that $50 a fee a year per fee. That's what it would be at, is a $50 cost to the counties by implementing this maximum fee. And we hope to address that later in finance and stuff with them because we think that's important to do. I have my testimony in writing for you. I'd like to share that with you and give you an opportunity to look at that also. And if you have any questions that we could answer, I'd like to see I'd be more than happy to answer them for you. I've seen providers make choices like whether to pay their licensing fee or whether to pay insurance, and having providers not carry liability insurance in their daycare homes is quite frightening to me. This is a serious problem. I had a degree in early childhood education and provided licensed family child care in my own home for 28 years. I moved to a C3 license where you could have two adults, which meant that I would have a 7-to-1 staff-child ratio, because I learned that low staff-child ratios were important to the quality of care. In a good year, I paid taxes on $12,000. If it wasn't for my husband subsidizing my income, I wouldn't have been able to stay in child care the years that I did. And I don't want to see us make this even more burdensome for people who would opt to be licensed and provide better care for children.
Thank you. I had the opportunity to meet with Beth Mork in New Prague with some other care providers, and the information you provided was very important. I represent part of Scott County, so I know what you're talking about. I think there may be one more testifier, Kate Lerner. She. State your name for the committee, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kate Lerner. I am the director of MAXA, which is the statewide association representing county social service directors from all of Minnesota's 87 counties. And I want to start by applauding the committee and Representative Slawick for addressing some of the challenges that currently exist for providers. Counties certainly recognize the importance of having access for families to high-quality child care programs, and we certainly want to do whatever we can as counties to reduce barriers to providers existing as a viable business within our community. However, counties do have some concerns about the bill that I'd like to express to you today. Primarily, as you're all aware and as previous testifiers have mentioned, when counties took over the responsibility to complete inspections as part of the licensing process, they were granted the opportunity to charge up to $150 as an annual fee to cover their administrative costs for carrying out these inspections. And for most counties, this is a fee that does not currently cover their administrative costs. Prior to today's hearing, I did have the opportunity to talk with Representative Slawick and express our concerns about the fact that we're concerned this bill will further limit counties' ability to cover their administrative costs for carrying out these inspections. However, as one of the previous testifiers mentioned, MAXA and our counties are committed to working with SEIU and also providers that union represents to address some of our concerns with this bill outside of today's hearing.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifiers, Representative Slawick, I had the opportunity to talk to one of my constituents yesterday who is a child care provider. Totally supports this bill, and I also do. I said there's two things that I find interesting. I said, well, what about a free fee? What about no charge for a fee? And she said, no, we need to have a fee because it designates us as a professional, and one of the testifiers indicated that I thought that was typical of child care providers and just how they are, period. The second thing she did suggest, though, and this isn't in the bill, and this doesn't need to be part of the bill, but it is a problem that I just brought up in state government as well. She said that when I have a substitute come in, substitute educator in her child care, she has to do a background check. If that substitute goes next door to her other provider, they have to do a background check. If that same substitute goes to a third provider, they have to do another background check. Every time that sub goes to another provider and testifies, you can correct me if I'm wrong, another background check needs to be run with additional costs to the providers. I found that, this came from her, I found that interesting. In our state government, we just talked about duplication of service and waste of service, and I asked that same question, but in case the state doesn't process, in case that part of the bill doesn't go through, is there a way that we can somehow say once a background check is done, then it's done, and the providers don't have to pick up the additional costs of that fee? Does that make sense?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, and I can have the Kate from MAXA or if somebody wants to testify about this. So my understanding is that this bill would centralize the function, and it's through the really the BCA that works out, and then you would be right. It would be one background check, and then they would be eligible or able to work in the different facilities, is my understanding. As you know, if they move right now, it's a background check per each time that they move. If the state performed the check, that wouldn't be an issue, so it would be more efficient. So that's what I would say. That's a very good suggestion.
Representative Fritz.
Yes, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Sovik, and all of the testifiers for bringing this bill forward. I have a question and a comment. I have a daughter-in-law who is a licensed practical nurse who had a daycare in her home, an excellent daycare. And I wonder, you know, when she needed to go into a doctor's appointment or something, then I would come out and spend an hour there. And I have the background check with my nursing license from my nursing home. And just wondered how, I mean, wouldn't that transfer? Isn't there a way of streamlining so that, I mean, you know, the state did, you know, it all comes through the state.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
We have Jerry Kerber here from the licensing department. I'll have him answer. That's a good idea. I mean, would it work, but he can tell us what happened.
Please state your name for the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the director of the licensing division of the Department of Human Services, and we are the agency to whom this background study responsibility would transfer. We currently do about 225,000 background studies a year, and we do them on people who work in human services license programs, health department license programs, including nursing homes and hospitals, some corrections programs, and a variety of other types of settings. And so to answer your question, Representative, the prior question as well, we do certainly have a centralized system that's in place, so we know whether or not somebody has passed a background study. The challenge we have, of course, is when people commit new crimes or they commit some kind of a child maltreatment or a vulnerable adult maltreatment that is relevant to their background study. Then when we get that information either through the criminal justice system or the child protection system or adult protection system, we need to know where the people are so we can notify the license holder that this person has a new disqualification. That doesn't mean that we can't use one background study for multiple sets of multiple provider situations. It's just that we have to have a mechanism for knowing about it, and that's something that we certainly can work on.
Thank you. That does answer, I guess, my question. And the comment that I have is I was looking up, I paid my nurse's license, which I have been doing for 42 years, and now I'm not working, but I still keep it because you never know if this job goes down. I'll have to go back to the nursing home again. And I happen to look back, and my nursing home license is $85, and that's for 2 years. So I just wanted to share that with all of you.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you follow that? That's good. The legislature as prevention from ending up in a nursing home. To the bill, number one, I appreciate it. I think the cost to providers, and we're constantly talking about how do we create greater access to quality child care, and the cost to private providers can be rather astronomical. I'm wondering a couple of things. $50 even seems like a lot. I worked with an organization until recently that had to do numerous volunteer and staff background checks and did them for substantially less than $50 or even $25. And I realize that may not be all the costs captured here, but I am wondering what is the average cost that counties currently charge for this, since it's been a county responsibility and now it's going to become Department of Human Services. What do we have any analysis of what counties have charged on average for this? And then do we know what the actual cost of a background check is?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that one of the things you've been handed out by Representative Slawik is a chart that is part of a report to the legislature from last year that shows county by county what fees were being charged. The first column is the licensing fee, and the second column is the background study fee. And as you can see, there's quite a variety of arrangements the counties had there, ranging from certainly some counties charge zero, and some counties charge the maximum on a routine basis. To the to the question about what is the cost of a background study, I think the actual cost, background studies cost different amounts kind of depending on the situation. A run-of-the-mill background check when we do them with the Department of Human Services includes a couple of costs. One is our accessing information from the BCA that we have set up a very streamlined electronic process. So that's only costs us $2 per study. In some cases, we have to go to the FBI based on the statutory guidelines, whether there's reasonable cause to believe that there's an FBI record there. And in those cases, the FBI has a charge of $29. There are other sort of administrative costs involved with that because we have to do certified mail and we send a variety of notices. And so all told, for our background studies done by the department, we average them out to be about $20 a piece. And that's, some are cost us much cheaper than that. A person with no criminal history, you know, is good business for us because it's we don't pay much. But if somebody has a lengthy criminal history, end up disqualifying the person and they exercise all of their appeal rights, including hearing rights in some cases, it can be pretty costly. But all told, it's averaging out about $20 per.
Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up. Is it standard practice to recheck backgrounds, what, every 3 years? Is that usually the rule of thumb?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, it's for family child care providers now, there's a requirement that the background study is repeated at the time of relicensure, which is, in most cases, is every 2 years. And the purpose of that is to see whether or not something new has been placed in their criminal record. What we're working on at the Department of Human Services through our connection with the BCA is what they are referring to as a wrap-back system, where we will subscribe to a BCA service where they will keep track of all of the people that we have initiated a background study on, and then when there's something, when something is added to that person's criminal history, they will notify us. Currently, we have a system in place where probation officers and correction agents are required to notify us of new criminal history. And that's working reasonably well as far as we know, but we don't know what we don't know. But the new system will certainly be much better.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other testifiers who'd like to speak to this bill? Okay. Step forward and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Amy Cockett, and I'm from Olmsted County. I feel like I should say something since Olmsted County is referred to as one of those greedy counties that charges the full amount. And I wanted to give you an idea on what it is we do for that money. And we really are not paying down the property tax with this, although perhaps you thought that was true. In 2005, the cost for our child care licensing in Olmsted County cost us $294,000. Our fees brought in $118,270. So as it is, the property taxpayers in Olmsted County are already eating part of this. And I would like you to consider also that sometimes using the word licensing, I know people up here have been talking about, well, how much it costs for a plumber to be licensed or a physician to be licensed. And a lot of those are kind of paper things where you send in, you know, you prove that you have passed the boards, et cetera, and then you're a licensed physician. I don't think that when we license a doctor in this state that somebody actually comes out to see how the doctor is performing or see how he or she sets up their office. And the licensing that is done for child care, and I imagine it must be around the state, not just in Olmsted County, is much more intense than that. In fact, I just got off the phone with one of our licensors who said, in a new situation, takes 7 to 9 hours to license. And I said, you mean you spend 7 to 9 hours in somebody's house? And he said, no, we make 2 half-day visits and then the paperwork follow-up. Which also includes phone calls and possible variances. There's a lot that's involved in this. Some of it's mentoring, some of it's inspection. So it is a bigger deal than the licensing that I think somebody goes through to be a plumber. Perhaps I'm incorrect. Maybe those are also hard. But I just wanted you to know that that is what at least Olmsted County is doing for these fees. And We figured out that if a daycare provider had five kids charging $100 a week, that the $250 fee would cost $1 per kid per week. And at least I know the people that do this work are on the side of God and the angels, and they are way underpaid for what they do. But I want you to consider, if you cap what the counties can charge, that it is a, it's one of two things. It's either a push more on the property taxes, and in our case, we will lose one licensor because it would cost us about $50,000. So it's either that, or on the other side is perhaps you'd like to consider that maybe you don't want to have such a difficult licensing. Maybe you just want it to be a paper license. You don't want this kind of a thorough thing. A third suggestion I would have for you, so that counties and state don't get in these kinds of battles when we both want good child care, is to consider that maybe you'd like to privatize this, because perhaps the child care resource and referral system in the state could provide this service for less money than counties could. So I just want you to think about those things, that we're not trying to hurt our daycare providers. We certainly want them to be good, and we're not trying to run them out of business. But we are really squeezed on the property tax side also. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Slawick, did you have anything more you wanted to say on behalf of the bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I want to thank all the testifiers that have come and traveled today to talk about this bill. As you can see, they're very passionate. It's very important to them. I want to also thank the SEIU members that are here today for being here and for your work each and every day that you are out there doing. I think it's really important for all of us. So we want to thank you for that. And Representative Fritz even wore her purple in honor of SEIU Day, I think. And members, part of this is getting this idea on the table for the omnibus bill, and it looks like we may need to do some work on the details as far as the levels. I think we're going to need to think that through, but I'm hoping that the committee can move it forward for inclusion.
Okay. So I think we will move it to the table for inclusion in the omnibus bill, and Representative Gottwell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I am a little concerned at the last testifier that, you know, are we in fact looking at an unfunded mandate on counties? And that is a concern. I don't know if you're able to speak to that, Representative Slawick, or not, but I'm sure that's something we don't want to do. But
Representative Galwell, I mean, we do need to look at that. Kate Lerner, in all full disclosure, was my first intern. And came in my office and told me she didn't like this bill. I almost fell over. It's the first time you don't like one of my bills and testified against it. So I know that she really thought that through, and that the counties are very concerned. And I think there's a somehow we can negotiate this. I can't quite see exactly how yet. I have to admit that. But I think there's a medium between helping child care providers and making sure we don't take income away from the county. I mean, we know the counties have been squeezed, but, you know, all of you know that's a long story for another day about what has happened in the state and why we can't provide our county services adequately and fund them. So I think that we need to work on that.
Okay. So consider the bill moved to the omnibus bill. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inclusion, possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And you have another bill you want to present to us.
Thank you. Yes, thank you all for coming. Today is kind of Nora Slawick Day, so yes, all the bills are mine. I didn't realize it would be work out like this.
Every day is Nora Slawick.
Well, it's a very special day here in the legislature.
Thank you for recognizing that, Representative.
House File 685, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee bill.
Okay. Do you have any amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have DE2, HO685 DE2, which I'd like to, is a delete all, if I could move that.
Okay. Any discussion about the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of moving the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Go ahead and present your
Thank you. House File 685 members has gone through the E-12 committee, Carlos Mariani's committee, already. And what this bill is about, this is one of those where you debate whether you name an organization or not. We're going through this debate in the Health and Human Services Committee. But in here it is named. It's LifeTrack Resources. That's what the amendment did. That if you haven't seen LifeTrack, if you're driving down University and going west from the Capitol, they have a big mural on the side of the wall. And I hope members, this is a place where our committee has visited in past years, and I hope we will go and visit LifeTrack. It is a place where children with very serious issues have their preschool experiences, issues of abuse, issues of parents with chemical dependency issues. And it's a place that is serving a very important population and helping get kids ready for school. And I'm very happy to see Karen Corbett here again today with her daughter. She talked with us in the E-12 committee and talked about what happens in this program and what this program has done for her family. This is the only program in Ramsey County. Compared to Hennepin County, there are several. So with that, I'd like the testifiers to talk further.
Please introduce yourself for the committee.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Kristen Meiskens, and I am the staff psychologist, child psychologist at Families Together Therapeutic Preschool, which is a program housed in LifeTrack Resources. LifeTrack Resources early childhood and family programs are dedicated to the most at-risk and vulnerable children ages 0 to 5. Our center and licensed staff provide the only combined therapeutic preschool and home visiting program in Ramsey County. LifeTrack Resources help our most fragile children heal and develop new relationships and begin learning the skills that they need in school and throughout their lives. Each year in Ramsey County, over 800 children under the ages of 5 in Child Protection Services are in need of early intervention and learning services. It's currently estimated that only 15% of these children receive the quality early childhood and family services needed in order to stabilize their lives. Currently, 50% of children in child protection under the age of 5 have elevated scores on a mental health screening. These children face numerous stress factors: poverty, child abuse, neglect, family violence, homelessness, chemical dependency, and mental illness of their caregiver. And as we know, the research shows that the constant stress of these risk factors changes how a child's developing brain operates and prevents healthy social and emotional responses. The most critical time for this brain development is from birth to age 5. Children who grow up in high-risk families, especially where there's abuse and neglect, experience 4 to 10 times more alcoholism, substance abuse, depression, and suicide later as teens and adults. These highly at-risk young children need appropriate services to prevent these long-term consequences. One of LifeTrack Resources' early intervention and learning programs is Families Together. And this is the only year-round therapeutic program in Ramsey County specifically for highly at-risk children. Hennepin County does have about 13 similar programs. LifeTrack Resources focuses on geographic areas with the highest percentage of poverty and child abuse children or neglect, the kids that suffer from child abuse or neglect. The children we serve in Families Together have, on average, about 5 of these risk factors. Children within our program may otherwise not be serviced because they don't qualify for special ed, or they have difficulty succeeding in less intensive or less comprehensive programs such as like Head Start or ECFE. St. Paul Public Schools School Readiness Program, Head Start, and Ramsey County Child Protection Services are referral sources for our program among our program partners. Home visiting is also an important part of our program. And we also have another program called Beginnings, which provides mental health home visiting services for ages 0 to 3. And they focus on attachment issues with children in need. And this is a voluntary child-focused program. So it ensures parent development or cooperation and indicate they want to participate and don't feel like they're forced to. LifeTrack Resources has decades of experience working with families who struggle with multiple challenges. And our goals is to work with each family not for each family. LifeTrack Resources works with young children and adults in their lives, providing the first stepping stones for the path out of negative cycles of poverty and the despair and anger and hopelessness that they produce. As you know, thanks to the work of Art Rolnick in raising up this issue, a dollar investment you invest today in a high-quality early education experience, is like the one we have to offer at Families Together, results in a $17 return in investment on for these highly at-risk young children. And I'd like to turn over to a parent of a child who's currently enrolled in our program, Karen Corbett.
Hi, I'm Karen Corbett. This is my daughter, Jayla Corbett. I have two children, a son that's six who was also in the program. Jayla's currently in the program. We started at LifeTrack 3 years ago. My husband had just entered alcoholism treatment, and I was just coming through a bout with cancer. And when my kids entered the program, my kids couldn't go out into public without being very scared. Oftentimes would cover their face. Jayla would always hide her face. If you would have stopped her at, say, Target and tried to talk to her, she would have covered her face and she wouldn't have been able to look at you. Going to LifeTrack, what has helped my children is not only to learn how to be able to communicate, but it's, they've learned how to recognize and express their feelings. They've learned how to communicate with their peers. Jayla, as you can see, is sitting here without having to have her face covered. She's not hiding from any of you. My son is excelling very, very well in kindergarten. And Families Together is not just for the children. Families Together also helps the families. They LifeTrack has been an incredible support. Since being there, I've had another bout with cancer. I've been chronically ill, and LifeTrack has continued to be a support for us and continue to help the children to be able to work with us as their parents and, you know, just some of the struggles that we have. And I'm very grateful to LifeTrack because I believe that my two younger children can now become positive, productive members of our community, and solely because of LifeTrack, because of the work that they've done.
Thank you. Are there any questions for these testifiers? Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was almost flipping this over to see if there was more to it. And that is one of my questions. How do you define underserved counties? And a second question, how are you going to define or assess children at risk of these various things? I realize LifeTrack is one program, but it doesn't refer to LifeTrack in the legislation. It appropriates a $500,000 for serving this group of people. I'm just wondering, are there some details to that?
Mr. Chair, members, are you looking at the delete all? Representative Gottwald? There's a delete all, HO685DE2. It gets a little, one of your questions gets answered in there, and that it does on line 1.5 and 1.6 talk about the LifeTrack resources in Ramsey County for at risk. I think I will turn to Ms. Meiskens and have her talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do a pre and post assessment for the children that are enrolled in our program to determine, you know, the areas that they have increased, specifically to school readiness related skills. And so there is a standardized measurement that we use to track progress. Oh, how do we define at risk? Well, go ahead and jump in here.
Just state your name for the record and pull the microphone towards you a little bit. Yeah.
I'm Cindy Taub, and I'm the Vice President of Programs at LifeTrack Resources. How we define risk is based on a number of factors. In order to be eligible for the program, a child must be in poverty, first of all. The child has to have at least a delay in at least one developmental area, and that tends to be for our children, either social, emotional, or speech and language. Those are the two most common, although you could have several factors. And then in addition, there has to be a family risk factor, and the family risk factors were things like chemical dependency, homelessness, abuse, neglect, and on average, our children have five of those risk factors. And so most of our referrals come either from Ramsey County Public Health Nurses or from Child Protection, directly from Child Protection. But I would like to say our program is always voluntary. It is not a court-ordered program, and parents, you know, I know our parents have said that they get so much more family support because of the home visiting component. So if they need to get to the doctor to get shots or the food shelf to get food, we will take care of that.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, this isn't really a question, but just a comment. I've, in my short career here, am learning a lot about LifeTrack, and they are, you know, a very wonderful asset to Ramsey County, and I think for families with children struggling. And I'm really grateful that you brought this forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
For anyone else who wishes to testify to the bill. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch. And while EdWatch very much appreciates the intent of this bill and the work that LifeTrack does, we also have a little bit of concern about the at-risk language in there. And although it's very nice and very comforting that the program itself says that it's voluntary, we would really appreciate that being delineated in language, because there is no reference to that, and there's also no discussion of how, and there's no reference to current statute that even pays lifts, you know, with the already current concerns about voluntary with other home visiting programs. So if this goes forward, we would really appreciate explicit language about voluntary and also explicit delineation of the risk factors that are there. And then we would also appreciate delineation of the consent for the review of records of how people are brought into the program, and that there be the Tennyson warning, which is what's already required in state law, so that families know what's being done with all of the data that is being reviewed to bring them into the program.
Any comments to that concern? Representative Slavik?
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to work with you. I would need to see what LifeTrack's reaction to that is. I think some of those are you know, voluntary in particular is something we can work with. I think that we just need to have a conversation about the rest of it, because I need to know exactly how that could work. Because these bills are being rolled into the omnibus bill, there is room and a little bit of time to work on some language and trying to make sure the bill is maybe closer, or that we can come up with some kind of compromise.
Okay. Representative Gottwald?
Briefly, Mr. Chair, the only other concern I have, I've brought it up before, and maybe as a freshman I need to be educated about this, but this is $500,000 going to Ramsey County, and I've got to believe that there are kids at risk all over the state of Minnesota, and I realize these do come in on a community-by-community basis, but I keep thinking, if it's good for Ramsey County, should we be looking at it elsewhere in the state?
Okay. Thank you. Any further comments, Representative Slavik?
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I hope you'll look favorably upon this. I want to thank the test pilot, Karen and Jayla, and everybody for coming. You know, it's you know, life isn't always easy for people, and I think that this is one of those bills that where we talk more about that, and I really appreciate them coming, because I think everybody struggles with something, and I think part of our role in government and as a state is there is a role for us for helping people when they need, when they are in need. And then hopefully, you know, as kids grow up and we know if they get the help on the front end, it saves the state a lot of money on the other end. So I hope with that you'll consider this bill and give it favorable consideration.
All right. So with that, we'll lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill and move forward. You have another bill, Representative Plowick.
Yes. Mr. Chair, we have House File 976. I'd like to move House File 976 for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Learning Finance Bill.
All right. And do you have any amendments for?
Yes, I do. I have H0976A1.
Okay. And you want to move the amendment?
Yes, I move that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And you want to comment on the amendment or?
The comment is actually just cleaning up the bill in terms of the amounts. It's actually putting in it's from $10 million to $5 million per year and then cleans up through June of 2009 and then it adds it into the agency's base.
Okay. All right. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Move the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill about after-school learning enrichment grants. In our committee, we also have this as part of our program in addition to our early childhood funding. Back prior to, I think, 2003, this was unallotted by the governor, and within 30 days, funds to several after-school and community learning programs were cut off at that time. So over 160,000 young people were affected by these changes. So all of a sudden, many young people didn't have access to these programs. We all know from our time at the legislature, and as we get here every day, we hear more about what after-school programs can do, both for academic achievement, kids that need that little bit of extra help, that tutoring, that help with the homework. You know, when mom and dad are still at work, they can get some help through an after-school program. Also for the crime rates, you know, this is a program that addresses keeping kids busy doing good things, and I think that's very important. So I have several testifiers here today, and I will turn it over to there. I think are the young people going to testify as well. So we know, Mr. Chair, we have till 5:30, and we still have
one
more
this.
Very short bill to go after this,
okay.
But
right. Okay.
Appreciate it.
So be brief if you can, but state your name for the committee and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura LaCroix-DeLune, and I'm the Executive Director of Youth Community Connections. We're an alliance of over 250 public and private organizations ensuring school-age children and youth have access to quality after-school and community-based learning opportunities to learn, grow, and develop. Young people, as you may or may not know, have over 2,000 hours of discretionary time when they're not in school. How young people spend this time is directly linked to how successful they are as they learn, grow, and develop through adolescence and into adulthood. When young people engage in meaningful after-school and community-based learning opportunities, they're more connected with learning, with school, and they're more connected civically within their own communities. These intentional connections can help young people avoid things such as crime or teen pregnancies or other negative issues that we are hoping young people can avoid. After-school and community-based learning opportunities provide young people access to learning about and building character skills in the safety of the community and with caring adults. Many business leaders are calling for these skills, and these skills would include such things as decision-making, leadership, problem-solving, and team-building. These aren't the things that they're getting in the day-to-day classroom and are essential to working in the workforce. We heard this clearly from young people when they attended the rally for youth at the Capitol last week, that they need a place where they can practice, make mistakes, figure out how to get better at doing these things in a safe environment. After-school programs and community-based learning opportunities really are the places where a lot of young people get these opportunities or can practice these skills. As you heard Representative Slawick mention, these are the types of skills that young people need that help contribute to closing the achievement gap. It's not the magic bullet, but it's one important piece of the puzzle that a lot of young people don't have access to. We know that graduation rates can rise up to 91% when we continue to invest in school-aged children through graduation. We believe that these are the types of investments that are wise for the state of Minnesota to make. We know they benefit the children, youth, and families of communities across the state. And we look forward to your support in this effort. And I'll turn this over to my colleague, Brian Severson Hall.
State your name and give us your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Brian Severson Hall. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota School Age Care Alliance. It's a statewide organization that supports after-school programs for children and youth ages 5 to 14. One of the main things we work on is helping programs to improve the quality of their program, professional development for their staff working with the kids in the program, and promote access for programs throughout the state. Over the past 5 years, Minnesota has seen a 46% increase in the number of 10 to 12-year-olds going home alone unattended. Participants of after-school and community-based learning programs have better school attendance, better grades, more positive attitudes towards school, and higher aspirations for post-secondary education. After-school and community-based programs are an important part of the solution for addressing our educational disparities. After-school programs allow for involved youth, engaged parents, and supportive communities. We believe that after-school programs come alongside parents and support them in their important role of raising children and youth. We believe that youth development develops our communities. When we have kids that are engaged, our communities benefit from that. And they benefit from caring adults. The more caring adults they have, the more connected they are to the community. One of the things that I will state before some of our youth who are involved in programs come up to talk is that I'm excited about this grant bill because it addresses the needs to support existing programs, but more importantly, it also addresses the need to promote and increase access for communities that do not have after-school programming. So thank you for the opportunity to give this testimony.
Thank you. Did you have other testifiers?
Yes, okay. I have one more with a group of students.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Wright. I'm the director of the Minneapolis Beacons Network, which is a collaborative that turns Minneapolis public schools into youth and community centers during the non-school hours. This collaborative includes the YMCA, the Boys and Girls Club, Community Education, and the YWCA in Minneapolis. And we're just here today to use Beacons as an example of the kind of after-school program and opportunities that would benefit communities through this bill. And I just want to say briefly, as the director of Beacons, that there's such a need for these types of programs in our community. Many of our centers have waiting lists. We served over 2,700 young people in Minneapolis last year, and we continue to see just a great need in the community. We're also seeing great outcomes from these programs. Teachers reported that 86% of Beacons Center participants maintained or improved academic performance last year. 84% were seen by their teachers as more motivated to learn as a result of the program. 98% of youth said that Beacons helped them like their school better. And 100% of parents that were surveyed said that Beacons helps their child do better in school. So I appreciate the opportunity for us to speak today. And when I learned that we could include the voices of some young people as well as a parent involved with the Beacons Centers, we welcome the opportunity. I do have to tell you that some of the staff from the after-school program said, at 4 o'clock? But we need them. And so it's we have two high school students who are with us who participated in the programs when they were younger and are now giving back to the community, working after school with younger students. We serve kindergarten through middle school, but then have many high school students that work with us. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Judy, who's one of the young people that our staff did not want to part with today, but understood the importance of her coming here to give her perspective on the great need we're seeing for after-school programs. So I thank you, and I'd like to introduce Judy Williams.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, move closer to the mic and then state your name for the record.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I'm Judy Williams. I am a peer educator at Nellie Stone Beacons, and I, for one, would like to say that without me being a participant in Beacons while in 7th through 8th grade, I could not understand where exactly I would be right now, because so much of my time without having somewhere to go right after school could have been spent elsewhere. I could have been doing anything else that could not have been productive and could not have taught me transitioning skills and better vocational skills on how an adult should carry themselves, responsible attributes that are very necessary in all teenagers and young adults' lives. And for, you know, even to be here, to have this opportunity to sit here and even explain to you how important it is to, that most students should have an opportunity to come to, like, their state capital and talk to people about why they feel what they're a part of is important. Beacons gives plenty of students that are younger students that do not feel they have a sense of purpose or reason to understand that I am necessary, I am needed. Because if I don't come to my class, my teacher misses me, and she says it, and we know it. And if I don't go, I don't have help with my homework because mommy has to work late, you know? It gives them that opportunity to get things taken care of. And they understand that I have to do it. It gives them, like, their responsibility, you know? And without the Beacons program and without after-school programs in the counties and Minneapolis public schoolings, a lot of kids will be deprived of what they do need and what is good for them and their parents. And I feel that, you know, anyone that can be a part of such an investment as Beacons should feel proud. Like, you know, I go to work every day and I work with third and fourth graders and sixth through eighth graders, and, like, sometimes it makes you feel like it's all for nothing, but in the back of my mind, I know that they appreciate it, and that's what is going to happen when they find out that those people that sit there and they have on business suits and they may seem like they're frowning, they appreciate the help that you guys do give them and will give them, hopefully. Thank you. Have a nice day.
How old are you, Judy?
I'm 16.
Okay.
He's 17, September 4th.
You know, my office knows that every day at 2:30 there's a little crisis in my office, and I'm waiting for my son to call, who's 15, and to make sure he's home, and what is he doing, and what's his homework. And I mean, it's a very real situation for a lot of parents in terms of what our kids are doing. So it's very good to hear about what you're doing and how productive you are after school. And welcome to the committee. You want to say your name and testify?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ashante Lynette Franklin of South Minneapolis, and I just want to say thank you to Judy, because I'm listening to her and it feels like I'm listening to my own daughter saying those same things, that they really do appreciate our hard work, so that's good to hear. A lot of people say that I'm too young to have three children. My oldest daughter, Precious, she just turned 15. I have a middle schooler who is 13. I just had all these birthdays come up, so I'm sorry. And then my youngest and my last child is, she is just turned 9 last week. But I am a mother, regardless of how young I look, I am a mother. And as I continue to grow in this role, I have become more of the type of mother, neighbor, and citizen that you would want, that I would want living in the community. I credit my contributions largely to the Ann Sullivan community, the YMCA Beacons community, and the Longfellow of Minneapolis community I credit my contributions to the Ann Sullivan community, the YMCA Beacons community, and the Longfellow of Minneapolis community to my mission to provide my children with the tools and support they need now to be the difference they inspire in me when they become adults. The YMCA Beacons After School Program is a huge part of my effort to accomplish that. My children collectively are gifted in performing arts, visual arts, tennis. Yeah.
Sorry, the mics just went off.
Go ahead.
Okay. My mission is to provide my children with the tools and support they need now to be the difference they inspired in me.
Yeah, You can go ahead. Yeah.
Okay.
Continue.
I enjoy saying this. I'll say it again. I credit my contributions in the community, in the Ann Sullivan community, in the YMCA Vegans community, and in the Longfellow community, in our neighborhood, to my mission to provide my children with the tools and support they need now to be the difference they inspire in me when they become adults. The YMCA Beacons After School program is a huge part of my effort to accomplish that. My children collectively are gifted in performing arts, visual arts, tennis, and each is strong in their leadership ability. The YMCA Beacons After School program offers a free and local class to match all of their gifts, which is phenomenal to me. The YMCA, or I'm sorry, that otherwise I would not be able to provide to my children individually. Being a single parent and working the hours that I do, I wouldn't be able to support all of their gifts without the YMCA Beacons program. They also enable me to use and share my own gifts and leadership abilities. If you're interested, I do encourage you to visit our YMCA Beacons After School program to get a real feel of how important the program is to the 300 to 500 children that they serve at that location. It is my immediate goal to partner with you to do what I can as a mother, neighbor, volunteer, taxpayer, voter, and hopefully soon to be homeowner, to ensure that many more children like my own can experience the opportunities, quality programs like the YMCA Beacons program has to offer. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. One final testifier. Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Chair and the members of the board. My name is Earl Lafayette Wimper, and I'm an employee of Minneapolis Beacons. I work at City View. What I would like to say basically is us running these school, these after-school programs gives us a chance to give back to the community, because I know when I was younger, I was in an after-school program, and I kind of looked up to the people who were running it. The simple fact that I know that these people don't necessarily get paid as much as a regular teacher would working throughout the day, that they're actually giving back towards the community, just giving their time. And that's what a lot of these kids need nowadays, is just time to be able to do their homework, to just interact with other people, because when they go home, they might not necessarily have a father or a brother or someone that they can look up to, a role model that can show them the proper skills to lead a successful life. And I feel like that's the type of role that I would like to play. And when I work for the after school program, is a simple fact that my little brothers and sisters, and I don't want them to go into the wrong life, and I feel like the after school programs gives them a place to be other than out in the streets, and that's the main thing that we need to stress, is that it gives them a positive environment to learn, to play, to learn different skills. We have different activities that we run all the time. We actually do half and half, where we do one part academic, another half physical, where I send my kids off to work on their homework and different activities that the teacher has set up, and then they'll come back with me, and I have them do team building games in the gym. And basically, I feel like that's what they need. These kids I love to see them. They smile every day. And it seems like as we go on more and more, because this is my first time ever working in an after-school program, it seems like as the time goes on, that the kids seem to get a little bit more comfortable with each other. Because when I first started working there, it seemed like they were new to each other, but they've been going to school all this time with each other. And I feel like if they can work with each other during the after-school program, then that can help them focus better during the school day, so fact that they see each other all day and they go home and tell their parents what they learned. Thank you.
I can see why they would miss having you not there. and you too, Judy. Anything else that you'd like to? We do have a question from Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I I know how good these programs can be. I was recently at the Youth of the Year with our Boys and Girls Club in St. Cloud, for example, and providing outstanding services. Big Brothers, Big Sisters, YMCA, we have church groups doing after school. We have our schools providing after school activities and community ed. I could go on. So I'm a little concerned about, we've already got some things going on. This is one-time money, as I understand it, correct? Or is this an ongoing?
Well, it's one-time money, but then it is put into the base.
Okay. So if it is one-time money, how are we suggesting that these groups, when they apply for the grants, use that money? Are they going to use it for operating? Because then, of course, I'd have a concern about where's the money going to come from in future years if you commit to operating expenses.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Laura LaCroix for the record, and Youth Community Connections is really dedicated to making sure that we're making sustainable investments. We don't want to see what happened in 2003 when resources were taken away. We understand that there are budgetary needs, but we really believe that these types of investments need to be ongoing. And consequently, we are working to try to leverage private resources that can help match or help support any state efforts that, that you may decide to do in this regard. So as far as long-term sustainability, we really believe that it's a three-legged stool that will help support these types of programs. It's public investments, it's private investments, and then there's those personal contributions that you heard from our testifiers even today talking about. Families are making commitments, kids are making commitments to their communities and getting civically engaged. Without all three legs of the stool collapses. So we are dedicated to working with the state of Minnesota and ensuring sustainability.
Good. All right. Mr. Chair, if I may, and I want to thank all the testifiers, too. I mean, I've heard so many of these stories, and it's clear that after-school programs are a critical part of our success. I think I got the long-term funding piece kind of figured out. So this is one-time money, but it implies that we're going to try to do this on an ongoing basis on the base. Okay. I think I have my question answered.
Mr. Chair, members, if I may, you just adopted an amendment that makes it part of the base. So this is ongoing money with the amendment that you just adopted earlier.
Mr. Chair, if I may, my other concern is we have so many needs in our education system right now, and a grant program is nice, but it to me it feels like something. You do grants when you've got the money, and if you don't have a lot of money, you try to put that on the bread and butter program, the E through 12 public system, if you will, that tells us they're in such need of funding. So I guess to members of the committee, that would be another concern. If we've got $10 million to spend in the next biennium, shouldn't that money be put somewhere else?
Thank you, Representative Gottwald. Anything else you'd like to say, Representative Slavik?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go out on a limb here. Okay. There is matching money for this grant as well. If the Minnesota legislature is willing to put up $5 million for each year, then the McKnight Foundation will match that for $1.3 million each year, meaning that if this legislature gives $10 million, we get $2.6 in matching funds. And
It's a $1.5 million, so you get an additional $3 million if the state makes this contribution. And again, that's because there's when the unallotment happened and the loss of resources happened, the private foundation community really had to step up to the plate. You make the point about where do you put the dollars. You have those tough decisions to make. I will remind you, though, that many young people, including those of you on this committee, have found your true passions for learning in your after-school programs or through community opportunities that you didn't get in the classroom. And if we only approach education and learning with a narrow perspective, we lose the opportunity to really inspire and give kids a reason to connect both in their own communities and with their school.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? With that, go ahead, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to just comment that I think this is a very important program, and partly because I have a bill that's very similar. and I'm trying to determine yet whether it goes to crime prevention or this area, because in essence it is a crime prevention bill that I have. It's in an area of great need, as I'm sure these kinds of grants would be, And, you know, I had the opportunity to watch the 2020 special with Diane Sawyer one night on a Friday night that brought me to tears. But in the and there were so many poignant stories about children and their needs. But the one that it ended with was, what could the communities do and what could society do? And one of the big pieces that at least the business community and many others said was those after-school programs are essential, that we have them in place, and then we find volunteers who will work in those places so that we have that kind of support for young people. And they need recreation, they need career counseling, they need just a multitude of kinds of services that are available. And so, to me, this is bread and butter, and you're right about the money. it's an issue, but I think we have to find money for some of these things. And we, you know, and when we talk about crime prevention, it is multifaceted, and one of the pieces is trying to find places for kids and give them rewarding activities so that they don't get into the kind of activities that are so detrimental to their communities. With that, the end of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I just say also Representative Dominguez does have a similar bill, as well as we're going to hear some similar bills on Monday, and potentially they all could be rolled into this effort, okay. Is one thought. So,
with that, I would lay this on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And you have one more bill and 5 minutes to present.
Lastly, well, I think we can do this one in 5 minutes.
Okay. All right.
The
very good.
The testifiers can come forward. Thank you all for being here, for taking part of your day to share your lives with us. If the ECFP folks can come down. Now, we've heard a lot about ECFP, and I think we all know what it is by now. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1172. 1272.
1272? Is that what it is? 1272?
House File 1272.
Okay. And do you have any amendments?
No.
Okay. I'll wait. So, I'd like to move the bill for possible inclusion for the omnibus bill. All those in favor, or is there any discussion? You don't have to do this? You're going to tell me about this? Pardon? Just let her testify. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Very good.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you if you could stick around just for a few minutes. This is the supersized version. You're seeing this sort of, you know, we have a supersized version of ABE. This is a supersized ECFE version. It gets it out on the table. Should there be some kind of huge cash influx to the legislature, we might be able to do this one. But also somebody in the audience, I won't say who, but somebody here today asked me to do this bill, and I really wanted to put it on the table to show the importance of what ECFE does for our families. And with that, I'll turn to the testifier. I think you probably have about 45 seconds.
I can do it really quick. Good afternoon. My name is Mary O'Brien. I'm manager of Youth and Family Services Programs for the St. Louis Park School District, and that includes ECFE coordinating. First of all, I want to thank Representative Slawick for introducing this bill. When word went out last week that it had been introduced, the emails that went around through my colleagues were like, wow. So we were very, very excited to see that. The question is simple. What would ECFE do with the additional funding? I think it's important to note that ECFE coordinators and staff across Minnesota had a number of things that they had to do when the program was unallotted in 2003. They continued to provide high-quality classes, but they did have to revamp the way in which services were delivered. And so I think one of the first things that many coordinators would be doing with additional dollars is trying to work to return to the level of service that they were providing when funding was at its all-time high of $120 per resident. But as many of you already know and have heard continually, ECFE coordinators are, and staff are continually searching for ways to best serve the children and the families in their communities. So in conversation with my colleagues around the state, here are some of the things that they indicated they might do if funding was additional funding was made available to them. Outreach and collaborative efforts would be reinstituted, intensified, and expanded. Some examples of possible activities would include hospital-based new baby visits, collaborative classes with public health, hospitals, early childhood special education, Head Start, and public libraries to support early literacy efforts, staff training and parent education programs in conjunction with child care centers, family, friend, and neighbor child care, the faith community, mental health providers, and early childhood screening. Expansion of parent education opportunities, collaborating with the K-12 system and others to specifically address infant child mental health issues, expanded services to parents and children ages 2 to 5, particularly crucial with the ever-increasing emphasis on helping children prepare to be successful in kindergarten and the research that places high value on parent involvement in these efforts. Additional programming for children and families at risk. In Alexandria, the dollars might go toward additional support for their long-standing family school for families with mental health issues. My colleague in Anoka Hennepin and I run family literacy programs, which are supported by ECFE funding. We agree that with additional dollars, we would re-intensify services in this program and add intensity where needed. As research indicates, intensity of service for families and children at risk is especially critical. Increasing the number of home visits and other school-to-home connections, including parent-child activities, more in the neighborhoods, in community centers, apartment building, common rooms, school buildings. Staff development and training to support staff as they address family needs coming into all Minnesota communities based on their changing demographics. Our most recent demographic information shows that 22% of ECFE participants earned less than $30,000 annually, and 10% spoke a language other than English. As these numbers increase, our ECFE staff will need additional training to assist them to best meet the needs of our changing community members. So in summary, what would we do with the additional funding? To paraphrase Garrison Keillor, ECFE would continue to go forward and do good. Nope, we would do great work. Thank you. Was that 45 seconds?
No. That was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you have another testifier? Or?
You know, there was supposed to be a parent here, Marge Porter.
Okay, there she is. Please introduce yourself for the committee.
Hi, I'm Marge Porter. I'm an ECFE parent alumni, actually, my family. It's very hard to follow her 45-second presentation, and I actually had 3 pages prepared, so I'll try to be brief. I think as parents we want to ask you is to support this House File 1272. This funding is important to our program. In St. Paul, we've witnessed many cuts, which you've heard, I'm sure, in hearings over the course of this session, and I did have outline, but I'll skip it for you. I think it's important to know that when adults who attend ECFE classes are asked to state their long-term goal for their children, in a single sentence, most say, "We want our children to grow up to be physically and emotionally healthy and to be contributing members of society." And I think it's important for this committee to know that ECFE provides the skills and the resources for parents to become the best teachers for their children. We're often confused by statements that ECFE doesn't serve enough families. When our funding continues to be cut and programs access to services are truncated, there's no doubt that we're not reaching as many families as we could. And I just, in closing, I'm very nervous in trying to respect your time. In closing, I just would like, on behalf of all St. Paul ECFE parents and parents statewide, to ask you to support this increase in funding, which is significant and will make a difference.
Okay. Do we have a couple of questions from members? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the third time I've seen this in a bill, and the first two times I didn't really care, but now I see it in the chair's bill, and it worries me. Is that I see that there's the increase in the minimum population guarantee from 150 to 180. And I'll offer my opinion on it, and then I'd like the author's comments on it, is that what this is doing, members, is it is providing school districts the funding for students they don't have. And while we don't need to reduce the amount of money, what we could be doing is using those dollars to pay school districts for students they do have, whether that's in St. Cloud or St. Paul or St. Louis Park, Brainerd, Faribault, wherever. And again, this is the third time I've seen this, and I'm concerned. And I would rather that we be using the money, whatever that budget number is, I'd rather be using it for ECFE students who are actually there as opposed to ECFE students who aren't there. And I'm just wondering if you could provide some commentary on what the other side of this is.
You know, Representative Graff, I'm going to ask one of the testifiers to talk about this.
Thanks.
Just state your name for the record again, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Graff, Mary O'Brien from St. Louis Park. I think one of the concerns that we have is that the smaller districts really need an amount of money that's sufficient for them to do programming with, and that's what we're looking at in increasing that number. We're not talking about necessarily, giving them dollars that
aren't there for non-existent children. In order to run the program, you have to have a good pot of money to begin with, you know, to support the work that it's that the program is going to do. And the 150 number isn't really allowing the programs to work, especially in greater Minnesota, where, you know, you may have to combine two or three districts to get an ECFE program up and running. So, you know, I think it's important that the districts that are running the programs and 338 of the 342 Minnesota school districts do run ECFE programs. They need those dollars. They just need a pot of money with which to begin.
Representative Garofalo?
Mr. Chairman, and I understand the that argument, but under Chairman Slawick's bill, they would receive an increase in funding just like the other districts were, but also they would get funding for 30 more students who aren't residing there. So what we're doing is we're taking, we're creating a population of, I'm doing the quick math here, I mean, we're funding 2,300 students who are not there, not in the population estimates. And we can, I brought my concerns up earlier in a previous committee regarding this and about how the statute reads, and the House research informed me that we actually don't even, when these population estimates for ECFE funding are out there, population estimates for adult basic education, once the census data comes out, we don't even require school districts to increase their to provide revised population estimates. So when these districts are in a state of declining enrollment, as many areas are, we're funding them for population levels that don't exist anymore. We're not even requiring in statute. And I just I want to impress upon members that we as a person who's from an area that's growing, we do a lot of things to help out declining enrollment school districts and small school districts. We all recognize the difficulties that exist there. We do quite a bit. And I'm just concerned about the fact that we are expanding a program which is already paying for phantom students, and we're expanding it even more, and by a pretty sizable amount, 20%. So I did want to express my concerns. And, again, the first two times I didn't say anything, but now that it's in the chair's bill, it brings to me a little higher sense of urgency. So if the testifier wants to, if I've said anything untrue or you want to correct the record, please, by all means.
Testifier?
No, thank you. Everybody wants to go home.
Representative Slavik, you want to?
Well, I think, you know, it's all a matter of your perspective. In districts that do have declining enrollment in areas, they still have to hire a teacher. I mean, teachers. As you know, ECFE teachers are licensed teachers, and so there are certain requirements for getting them to come and work for the program. So I think part of it is looking at that. I'd be happy to look into it further. These are concerns, you know, that are brought to us. I don't ever... maybe you think, but you know, in terms of motives or phantoms, or you know, we are trying to do good things for families here, not just about money. So I think we can articulate it, maybe get back with a more thorough response.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, just a final comment on that.
All right.
Just that, and Representative Slawick, you know this, that the way we work is we're going to get a budget number here, we're going to get a target that's going to be put out there. And in a world of finite resources, again, my preference from a good government and policy perspective, and no way, truth of the matter is, if you look at the school districts on that list, one of those districts that would benefit from it is my district. But from a good government policy perspective, in a world of limited resources, we should be paying school districts for ECFE students they have, not for ECFE students they don't have.
Thank you, Representative Cutwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Slawick, I'll make this brief, but she and I have had many conversations about the need for parental engagement, my passion for that. It's one of the reasons I support ECFE. I think it's one of those programs that really does that. And it also targets people who are at risk. You mentioned earlier the numbers. And I think that's the wonderful thing about it. My one concern about this bill, which is ECFE Additional Funding Deluxe, is the sustainability of the funding. I hate the idea of giving a lot of money and having to take it away as our economic cycles impact the state budget. Maybe you could comment on that, the sustainability of this level of funding.
Well, I think that Representative Greiling has an income tax bill. And as was suggested to me this morning, you could sign on it and you wouldn't have to worry about the sustainability.
That's a conversation for a different day.
Mr. Chair, I would just make reference to Mr. Garofalo's finite resources comment earlier and leave it at that. No, I think it's a good program. I do agree we need to put additional funding back into it. I'm just concerned about the amount.
Okay, thank you. Any other testifiers? Please. State your name for the record, and I need to ask you to be brief. We're already over our time, so.
Very brief. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I would just remind the committee of what I've said before about ECFE being good for parents, but not necessarily shown to be effective in improving the cognitive development of children. The second point I would make is that the testifiers are talking about expanding early childhood mental health screening and home visiting in big ways, and we have major concerns about that. The Center for National Infant and Early Childhood Health Policy admits on infant mental health, lack of baseline, lack of agreement about diagnosis, criteria for referrals and acceptance into services are not always well defined, lack of longitudinal outcome studies, appropriate assessment and treatment requires multiple informants, broad parameters for determining socio-emotional outcomes are not clearly defined, although much attention is now being given to school readiness. This is from a big proponent organization. And I would just say about home visiting, it also has not been shown to improve the cognitive development of children. On well-defined, well-controlled studies, it didn't improve the child's behavior problems or emotional regulation, mother-child interaction, child's mental development, mother's educational achievement or employment. And just regarding the other bill, I was mostly focused on data and consent issues, but if the state is going to spend $500,000 on that program, you may want to consider having some kind of outcome or effectiveness requirements
and
study.
Perhaps sometime you can provide us with that data. And any closing comments, Representative Slaw?
Just members, I think this is to get this bill out on the table and hope we can just get it on the buffet for the omnibus smorgasbord.
All right. And so with that, we will lay it on the table for possible consideration in the omnibus bill. And before we I would like to recognize Patrick McCormick, who may have a comment about it. Would you just like to introduce yourself to the committee and explain why you're here?
Members, my name is Patrick McCormick. I'm Director of House Research Department, and as esteemed staff member Daniel Lemire begins to transition toward maternity leave, I'll be transitioning in to help staff this committee.
Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned.